Welcome to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB, keeping levy payers informed and at the heart of the conversation. I'm John Bates, and thanks for joining us. In this podcast, we're talking to an MP who has more than a passing interest in food and farming. And we're also talking to AHDB's exports expert, Dr. Phil Hadley. But first, Sir Robert Goodwill MP, Conservative member for Scarborough and Whitby. He is the chairman of the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Select Committee, or EFRA, as it's better known. Sir Robert is a farmer and former MEP, and his main areas of political interest are agriculture, fisheries, environment and transport. In fact, he is a former agriculture, fisheries and food minister. He's also vice chair of the all-party parliamentary group on science and technology in agriculture. He holds an agriculture degree from Newcastle University. If I may say, listeners will be pleased to know that the man at the helm of the Select Committee has farming so closely ingrained. Welcome to this podcast, Sir Robert, and thank you for sparing the time.
Thank you, John. No problem at all.
Tell us about the work of the EFRA Committee, if you would, and what it's set up to do, because I understand that it's an important check and balance examining the work of government.
Yes, I mean, the Select Committees each shadow one of the government departments. And obviously, our job is to hold the government to account, to conduct inquiries about how the government's delivering. But also, we sometimes like to sort of get on the front foot and be a little ahead of the government and look at some areas where we think they might like to have a look. So, you know, for example, at the moment, we're currently doing a big report on UK trade policy as far as it affects food and agriculture, which is where Phil came in, as he gave evidence to us. We're looking at education and careers in the land-based sectors, looking at whether we actually are training the people we need for the next generation of farmers. We're doing quite a lot of work on fairness in the food supply chain, whether the supermarkets are exerting too much power over their supplies and whether the powers of the grocery code adjudicator might need to be widened a little more. We're doing one which is sort of, we have a couple of Labour members who don't represent rural areas, and we're doing a report on urban green spaces, because I think, you know, greening the urban environment is just as important as what we're doing in the countryside. And finally, we're doing one on pet welfare and abuse, looking at things like puppy smuggling. And also, we've done a lot of work on the XL bully dogs, which the government is banning, in effect. So, yeah, we've got a lot of irons in the fire at the moment. That comes on top of a number of other reports we've done in the past.
And importantly, you were elected by fellow MPs to chair this committee. But for this aspect of your job, it's above party politics, isn't it?
Yeah, it's cross-party. We have representatives from the Labour Party. We have an SNP member, although much of agricultural policy is devolved. So, you know, he tends to sort of come when it affects Scotland as well. But yeah, my job, I'm elected by the whole House rather than just by my own party. And obviously, I try to be as consensual as possible, because I think it's if you have a report that doesn't get the whole committee behind it, I think that's really a sign of failure. So we do try and ensure that we can be a consensus behind what we're saying. And so far, we've managed to achieve that.
So it's an impressive list of things that the committee is looking at just at the moment. And included in that, very recently, you've been looking at soil health. And one of the special advisors to AHDB, John Gilliland, he gave evidence to the committee recently, I believe.
Yeah, we just recently published the soil health report. And yes, John was very helpful. We certainly, I think, everybody understands about water quality and sewage and air quality and, you know, smoke and particulates. But actually, soil is a very, very complex thing. And of course, without good soil, we can't produce good food. And obviously, as the government's changing its policy from just giving, you know, just bunging a farmer a check every Christmas to actually having some green objectives attached to that. Things like the Sustainable Farming Incentive, which is all about managing soil. Our committee, I think, takes the view that we don't really know enough about how we manage our soils, how our soils are being degraded, how we can use our soils better in terms of maybe preventing flooding. But in particular, I think we need to look at the whole soil-carbon relationship and how we can increase the carbon contents of our soils as a way of sequestering carbon into those soils. And, you know, we all know, for example, you know, grassland is a great way of building up carbon and organic matter in our soils. But many of the arable fields, particularly on lighter lands in the east of the country, much of that organic matter has disappeared, which does actually make the soils more difficult to cultivate. It makes it more difficult for them to hold moisture and nutrients. So, you know, I think we need to do a lot more work in the future on looking at how we can manage soils. I think what is clear, and I know from experience of my own farm in this particular autumn, trying to get winter crops in, you know, it's all very well having a state-of-the-art direct drill or a min-till drill, but, you know, if the soil is wet and waterlogged, sadly, sometimes you have to go back to the plough and plough it up dry and drill it straight away with a combi drill. So, you know, we're talking to some other politicians. They think there's a lot of, you know, quick answers, and the situation is actually much more complex than that. But so I think as we're developing different ways of supporting farmers through the way that they deliver on better soil quality and better environmental outputs, I think, you know, soil is going to be key to that. And soil is every bit as important, if not more important, than water and air.
Absolutely. And I'm in Gloucestershire as we're recording this, and I know that there's a lot of fields in this neighbourhood where next year's crops are just not in the ground yet because it's been impossible to get on because of the wet.
Yeah, exactly. I was talking to a neighbour of mine up in North Yorkshire who reckoned about a quarter of his winter wheat has sort of rotted in the ground. They drilled it late to try and get on top of the black grass problem. And of course, there's still potatoes in the ground. You know, I'm not sure how many. I've not seen any figures, but, you know, that's going to have quite an impact on potato supplies over the winter. And, you know, one of the worst things you can do to soils is lift potatoes in a wet season, but you do not have any alternative. And I think we need to ensure that if the government does develop policies on soil management, they need to understand, you know, if it's a wet autumn and you've got potatoes in the ground, you can't afford to leave them there till it's dry enough to lift them.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, over the years, sort of post-war, farmers were incentivized, obviously, to grow as much food as possible for the population. And, you know, perhaps enough importance was not attached to soil health as perhaps it should have been.
Yeah, so, I mean, my father was a member of the War Agricultural Committee, and part of his work, as well as assessing damage caused by tanks training on the Yorkshire Wolds and compensating farmers, was actually they used to turf farmers off their farm if they weren't doing what the government wanted, which in that time was basically ploughing out grassland. That's a lot of permanent grassland, some of which, I have to say, probably wasn't the land most suitable to growing crops. But, you know, Britain was worried about the submarine blockade and starvation. And, you know, a lot of land was ploughed out and pressed into crops. And interestingly, when I was at university in the 1970s, we were talking about high nitrate levels in soil, still relating back to ploughing out all that grassland and the breakdown of that organic matter, which was still happening 20 years after or more after the end of the war. So, you know, what we do with our soils does actually have a bearing on other environmental situations, like, you know, the amount of ammonia and methane in the air, the amount of nitrates and phosphates in our watercourses. So soil is intrinsic to all that.
Now, at the beginning of the podcast, you made the point that the committee has been looking at trade policy, which is why Phil Hadley had been giving evidence to you. And we'd also, I think, ASDB had provided some written evidence as well. So why does the committee welcome information from organisations like AHDB and experts like Phil Hadley?
To put it very simply, we like evidence and facts, not just opinions. And sadly, a lot of politicians are very, you know, they're very big on opinion, but maybe not quite so high on facts and actually the scientific and statistical background to give that evidence. And actually, you know, in politics, it's very easy to exaggerate some claims. Dare I say, if you're standing to be president of the National Farmers Union, it's no bad thing to say we must stop all international trade because we're going to be swamped by food produced abroad on the conditions that aren't legal here. Now, you know, there is a point to that, but, you know, we hope to take a bit of perspective on this and, you know, look at how we can, I think, integrate our agriculture in a way that fits in with the new trade deals that are being forged. And, of course, trade is a two-way thing. You know, our biggest food or drink export is Scotch whiskey. India imposes 150% tariff on Scotch whiskey imports. They're our biggest, despite that, they're our single biggest destination for whiskey. And whiskey, of course, is made of malting barley, and that's an agricultural export. So, you know, we want to take a view on how we can work to have freer trade, because, you know, I'd rather, you know, help a developing country by buying its produce than by giving it aid. At the same time, we need to be absolutely certain that we don't import food from countries where production methods or chemicals that are illegal here can be used freely there. And we need to ensure, you know, in particular, for example, that we maintain our legislation to prevent hormone-treated beef and chlorinated chicken coming onto our market. And in the case of chlorinated chicken, it's not the fact that it's not safe to eat. It's the fact that because of the very intensive conditions in which chickens are reared in the United States, conditions that would be illegal here, they need to use much more sterilants in the food processing industry than we do. So, you know, I think we shouldn't be frightened of free trade, but we should be careful to ensure that our farmers get fair competition, because, you know, we produce the best quality food in the world, particularly in Yorkshire, I have to say. And that food is food that we can put onto markets all over the world, but we need to ensure that we're not inundated with products from, let's, for example, look at Mexico. Mexico produces a lot of eggs. The biggest consumer of eggs in the world, would you believe? But Mexico also doesn't have hardly any free-range hens. They're 99.9% battery hens. And we need to ensure that if we do have a trade deal with Mexico, that they don't compete on an unfair basis with the United Kingdom, because, you know, we have much higher welfare levels. You know, even in our battery cages, our welfare levels are higher than the ones in some other countries around the world.
Now, for AHDB to produce the evidence that goes before the committee, that obviously takes you know, an awful lot of work. There's a great deal of analysis that has to be undertaken. It needs to be robust, the evidence that's produced. Help us understand a little bit about what difference it all makes when it gets put before you and your fellow committee members.
Well, when we launch a report, we actually start off with a call for written evidence, and that evidence often helps sort of frame the report. It gives us indications, you know, what the concerns are, what direction that report might need to be. And then obviously people who've submitted written evidence will often be invited to give oral evidence as well, which is where Phil and his evidence came in on the 21st of November. And that was very helpful to us. Obviously, as a grain producer, I'm a levy payer. So, you know, I am pleased to see that work is actually feeding into some of the decision making or the advice that we give to government as it makes those decisions. So I think levy payers can feel that you know, the work that you're doing is actually fed into government and enables them to make more enlightened decisions.
Is the government compelled to respond to the reports that you prepare?
Yes. In fact, I've been a minister in three departments, and you know, I remember signing off those reports. Sometimes I'm afraid we do get quite lame answers from the government, and they're meant to respond in 2 months. And it's quite interesting. I'm talking out of school a bit here, but we had Therese Coffey came. We have regular sessions which are entitled "The Work of the Department." So basically, we ask the Secretary of State or one of the ministers whatever we want to ask them. And I know we were waiting for a number of reports and some correspondence replies which were well overdue. And would you believe they came in a little flurry just before she appeared, so we didn't give her a load of grief about that. But to be fair, I did have a meeting with Steve Barclay, the new Secretary of State, and I explained this problem about sometimes getting the government responses to our reports a little bit late and not replying to correspondence. And I have to say, he made it very clear he was going to do better. And to be fair, we did get a letter the previous day responding to some earlier points. So actually, I think he's starting off quite well. So, but yeah, it is important the government responds. And then we sometimes sort of come back at them and say, well, no, you don't understand what we're saying, or you really, you know, have got the wrong end of the stick, or maybe you should give this a bigger level of priority. I'm on the Northern Ireland committee as well, and that's very important, because a lot of farmers in Northern Ireland are still having problems at accessing vaccines, veterinary medicines. There was a big issue with seed potatoes, which I'm told has been resolved, and also issues with moving to pedigree livestock. So, you know, the select committees do great work in feeding in the concerns of farmers directly into the heart of government. And indeed, in the new year, as part of our sort of fair trade within the supermarkets and food chain, we're going to have a private session for farmers, explaining a little bit maybe how the supermarkets throwing their weight around a little bit are actually making life very difficult. And actually, if you look at what happened during the period after the invasion of Ukraine, where poultry feed got very expensive, and the egg farmers went to the supermarket and said, look, you're going to have to pay more for your eggs. And the supermarkets said, oh, no, we got a contract. And then would you believe the farmers didn't restock their sheds, and some of them, you know, retired. And then we had a shortage of eggs in the autumn, and there were stories about eggs being imported from Italy. So, you know, I hope that the supermarkets will look at our report and understand that, you know, if they want to put food on the shelves, they've got to pay people a fair price for what they're producing. And if they don't do that, they may well find that food won't be there, because people won't plant the crops that that they want to buy. And actually, to be fair, in my constituency, one of the biggest employers is McCain Foods, and they do get it. You know, their contract is responsive to fertilizer prices, to fuel prices and other input prices, because, you know, they need their growers, because they know without growers, they can't produce chips, and without chips, the supermarkets can't put them on the shelves. So, you know, I hope that our report, which will be coming out next year on fairness in the food supply chain, will not only concentrate the minds of the government and how they can maybe intervene at times to make that situation fairer, but also I think help the supermarkets to understand that they do need to understand that in order for them to continue to get supplies of good quality British food, they need to pay a fair price, and a price at which the farmer can make a reasonable profit.
Sir Robert, I'm also quite interested in your rather unique perspective, I suppose, you know, as chair of the select committee, as a levy payer, as an MP, knowing a lot about farming. You've been on an AHDB farm event, I think, and I just wonder what you think about the work that AHDB does and the value that levy payers, yourself included, you know, what you get, for, you know, in terms as a return.
Yeah, I mean, it was when I was a minister, I went up to a farm quite near Saltburn in Cleveland, and it was great, because I think that the one lesson I brought home with me was that the farmers are more willing to learn lessons from other farmers who are actually doing it than maybe sort of paid advisors or consultants who, you know, you sometimes wonder, you know, how much practical skill they have. And I remember that one particular thing that stuck in my mind on that farm, they were doing a lot of detailed yield mapping with their combine and the, you know, connected to the GPS. And at that time, they were looking at where they should put their, you know, their stewardship strips, where they should put their pollen and bird seed. And they could draw a pretty accurate map of the farm showing, you know, where those yields were low enough to make it worthwhile putting in those crops as an alternative. And I thought that was very interesting, because, you know, on my farm, we do have some, you know, strips, but we know where the wet patches are. We know where the bits where it's very stony and nothing grows. We know where the bits where the rabbits come out the wood and eat all the crops. So they're the bits that are there. But I mean, as the levels of subsidy, the level of support for different stewardship option changes, I think it's important for farmers to be able to calculate accurately where they're better off growing crops and where they're better off doing stewardship, or where indeed maybe, you know, one of the more sustainable production methods could be used, so they get a lower yield, but the support they're getting for that low input type of farming actually makes it worthwhile. So, you know, I think we all need to be much more tech savvy, and the AHDB is I think doing great work in doing that research and then making sure that lessons learned actually passed down to farmers on the ground.
Sir Robert, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you. That was Sir Robert Goodwill, a levy payer, MP and chairman of the EFRA Select Committee. You're listening to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB. Joining me now is our second guest, AHDB's Dr. Phil Hadley. So you've been called to give evidence, as Sir Robert has told us. You've been in front of the Select Committee several times, talking about exports and developing overseas markets. But I imagine there's a bit of a fine line to tread between lobbying and trying to get the best we can for levy payers.
Yeah, thanks, John. Great to be part of this discussion. You're absolutely right. I've spoken at EFRA and other evidence sessions a number of occasions. In terms of the fine line between lobbying, we are, as AHDB, not a lobby body, of course. We're there to give clear evidence-based answers and give insight to direct questions. So we're not lobbying for a particular train of thought or a particular policy. Our role is to provide that evidence to say, if you go down that route, these are the potential pitfalls or the benefits, and here is the evidence to support it. So in some way, to preempt those types of questions so that the evidence is available for decision makers to consider that evidence in that decision-making process without us saying strongly, you should do this or you should do that. We just present the evidence that guides the decision-making.
So tell us about the evidence that you gave most recently.
Yeah, so it was an EFRA committee panel about international trade and policy. And the question was really, what should government be considering? What are the risks and challenges and the opportunities for international trade to help shape policy and decision making around that? So we talked about trade liberalisation as the UK government strikes free trade agreements. We'll see more product on the domestic market. What might that do to UK agricultural production? What are the risks and what are the challenges? If we're going to have a more liberal market, we also need to make sure that UK farmers have the greatest opportunity for trade in the other direction. So it's incumbent on government to make sure that trade deals are balanced, to give UK farmers export opportunities in other countries to help balance the carcass and the seasonality of product, but also to take away potentially some of that pressure that might appear on the domestic market as a result of there being imported products available. So again, balancing that trade dynamic, but also importantly about UK farmers being able to compete on a level playing field, so able to be price competitive. We're not the cheapest producer, and we have requirements around animal welfare and medicine uses, for example. So to make sure that imported product is of a similar produced under similar circumstances, so that level playing field, so it truly is competitive without it being a race to the bottom on price, so that government have tools they need to make those decisions that give UK farmers opportunities more globally, and equally when imported product comes in, it comes in at a similar standard, doesn't present disease risks, and competes in the market on that level playing field.
So from a levy payer's perspective, the Select Committee might just seem like a million miles away from, sitting in the tractor or, worrying about things on the farm. But this sort of the independent analysis that AHDB do and the evidence that you present around sort of Brexit and free trade agreements and that sort of thing. This is a really helpful way to get to the heart of government, isn't it?
It is, and AHDB is recognised as an independent evidence and analysis-based organisation. So government and other organisations look to us to help them answer some of the questions, to shape their own policy and approaches. So, for example, we've done analysis on free trade agreements with Australia, New Zealand, the US that have been very well picked up and well publicised. We've done economic modelling that suggests if you take this approach, the likelihood of trade expanding or shrinking or changing look like this. But what that does is it provides well-researched evidence for that decision-making process, so that the impacts of any of those decisions have a clear and likely outcome, so that they're well informed from a very, very solid base. And the role that EFRA has here is really to kick the tires on government policy and make recommendations to government, bearing in mind the EFRA panel is made up of representatives from all political sides and from the devolved nations, is for them to be clear with the questions they're asking government and the recommendations they may make to government, so that all aspects are considered within that discussion and decision-making process. Because it's absolutely critical that we have well thought out evidence-based policy, because only then can farmers have the confidence to work with those policies. And that's where we come in, giving that evidence to support the decision making for the benefit of farmers.
And then just remind us of the context, because the efforts that you and your colleagues go to in the exports team, that produces some, you know, some pretty impressive statistics and numbers, doesn't it? So just give us those numbers just to remind levy payers of the value derived.
Well, we asked levy payers what they valued from AHDB most, and exports was a very strong towards the top for the livestock sectors. So levy payers value the export work. The team and I, we're looking for market opportunities. We're looking to open new markets, and we're looking to promote the products in those markets. The value of exports in 2022 across the sectors was 3.6 billion. So that gives you some idea of the income that is generated for UK agricultural producers and indeed our levy payers from having those markets open and being able to trade their products through their processors in the main into those international markets. Markets as far afield as China, Hong Kong, Singapore, the US, Canada, Mexico, the Middle East, far beyond Europe, and in the post-Brexit era. We need to be much bolder with finding new markets and exploiting those opportunities, as we indeed face more challenges on our own domestic market following free trade agreements.
It's a great story and it's well told. Thank you very much indeed, Phil Hadley. So that's Phil Hadley. My thanks to him, and of course to the EFRA Select Committee Chair, Sir Robert Goodwill, MP. Stay safe, stay well. I'm John Bates. Thanks for listening. If you have any comments about this podcast or have ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk.